From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Writer Irshad Manji is kind of a perfect storm of other people's indignation. She's gay, Muslim, and politically progressive, but she's been attacked, she says, by the LGBTQ community, by Muslims, and by progressives for daring to deviate from their political scripts. Manji says the outrage machine on the right is out of control, but so is the outrage machine on the left. And she says it's high time that people found the moral courage to stand up to folks who claim to be open-minded, but aren't. This hour on Point, Irshad Manji's call to stop labeling her and everyone else. And you can join us. Do you have friends who are too doctrinaire to have a good political discussion with? Or maybe is that you? Is shaming coming from all sides now, and is it harming the country? And liberals and conservatives, do you know how? Let's be all honest with ourselves. Do we know how to check outrage at the door and listen to somebody you disagree with? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Well, joining us today from Honolulu, Hawaii, is Irshad Manji. She's founder of the Moral Courage Project at the University of Southern California. And her new book is titled Don't Label Me, A Conversation for Divided Times. We have an excerpt of it at onpointradio.org. Irshad Manji, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me, and aloha.
Aloha to you as well. You know, I actually would like to start first with a little bit about the labels that you yourself have been saddled with, if I may, because I talked about them there in the introduction, and you write about it a little bit in the book. How have the labels of Muslim, gay, progressive had an impact on you?
Well, let me begin answering that question, Meghna, by pointing out that, you know, in your setup for the show, you said that labels define who we are. And I wouldn't say the word is define. I would say the word is distort. Mm. Labels distort who we are very often because they aren't just innocent descriptors of, you know, beings. Labels come with baggage, and it's often baggage that you, the person being labeled, have not bought into. So, for example, there are plenty of people clear across the country who, depending on their political perspective, will, you know, sort of view my label Muslim and say, aha, so she's a stealth jihadist. On the other hand, some will say, aha, she's corrupting Islam because of her other label, gay. Still others will say, aha, she's giving cover to the Islamophobes, because now they can say, look, we don't hate minorities. We love this gay Muslim who's critiquing Islam. So, you know, people ascribe meanings to labels, and that's what makes them so dangerous. Factually, the labels may be true, but we are all so much more and often very different than the baggage that accompanies those labels.
So this is then the heart of your book, Don't Label Me, which is, you know, aimed squarely at your fellow progressives, because right in the beginning of the book, this is what you write. You talk about the future of America and how the country, by definition, is becoming more diverse, racially diverse at least. And you say, what an incentive to use these next 20 years mindfully to learn from past mistakes about how finally to get diversity right. So far, though, diversity's enthusiasts are committing the same stale mistakes. We're attaching labels to individuals as if those labels capture the sum of who they are. Moreover, you write, we're labeling ourselves to the point of extinguishing our own humanity. What are you talking about?
Well, so the same stale mistakes of the past, to me, it just befuddles me how more of us on the liberal and progressive side of the spectrum are not seeing this. You know, we criticize the early North American colonists for taking individuals and slicing them up into labels, into categories. So for example, a human being wasn't merely a human being. He or she was black or Negro. And then assigning value to those categories. And in that way, the early colonists created a hierarchy of worth. Well, I have to say, I think, you know, we're doing the same thing now in the name of social justice. And at the bottom of the hierarchy are white, straight men. Now, I realize that that's an inflammatory, statement to make. But I have to tell you that it has occurred to me so often, and as the poster child or somebody who's been treated as a poster child of multiculturalism, I see this all the time. I'm in this position to see how diversity is being practiced. And it's being practiced as labeling. And somebody like me who is supposedly triply disadvantaged because I come from all of these different minority groups, is sort of at the top of the hierarchy, of people who deserve to be respected. But cisgender white men, screw them and forgive my language, goes the attitude, because they've got all the power.
But Yershan, can I just jump in here?
Sure.
Because, I mean, I imagine a lot of people right now are saying, yes, exactly. Why would the very group of people who has historically most benefited from structures of power, from holding power and privilege, require the sympathy or the dignity of not being labeled today?
You know, again, I have to emphasize, it's one thing to be labeled, but it's another thing to then use those labels to demean and humiliate. And yes, I realize the irony in what I've said, that has been done to people like me for generations. But as I ask repeatedly in Don't Label Me, if we're now doing the same to straight white guys, how is payback amounting to any kind of progress? Why is it okay if we do it to others when it was so wrong when they did it to us?
Yeah. Well, you write here that taking pride in our particulars at the expense of our commonalities has become a hallmark of, quote, progressive America. And then you elaborate. You say more and more of us in the, quote, diversity crowd label people as ignorant and insidious if they hold opinions that diverge from our script. We rally for diversity of appearance but flake on diversity of viewpoint. So you call it a dishonest diversity.
That's right, because it fixates on external markers like complexion and gender and religion, when in reality, even when you belong to any kind of a group, even when you voluntarily affiliate with any kind of a group, you don't stop being an individual within that group. And that's why if diversity is going to live up to its ideal, it has to include diversity of viewpoint. And by doing so, we're not compromising our ideals at all as liberals and progressives. We're saying that we're all about inclusion. And if a straight white guy has a different viewpoint than I do as a queer Muslim, well, you know, he's entitled to, because I'm practicing inclusion, not exclusion. Hmm. Now, whether that means, you know, do I walk away from him just because he disagrees with me? Absolutely not. I learn to engage. And in getting to know that person as a human being and as an individual, I can glean information about him or her that then allows me to reframe my own arguments in a way that they can hear. Meghna, I'll just sure. Bottom line it this way. There's an iron law of human psychology, and it's a very simple one. If you want to be heard, you first have to be willing to hear.
Hmm. But let me ask you so many questions, Yershan, so many. I think, are we not living in a day and age, though, where someone might hear you and say, yes, sort of intellectually and philosophically, I understand what you're saying, but some of these viewpoints that you're asking people to listen to acknowledge, to hear, are so repugnant that they don't even feel like there's even a droplet of validity. Not just even repugnant, but potentially, you know, harmful to themselves. Why should they open themselves up to listening to things that they perceive as dangerous?
Well, interestingly, in that very question, you emphasize the word harmful but you also preceded it with the word potentially. I would emphasize potentially harmful. We can't just assume that an opinion is harmful simply because it's been stated. We don't know where that opinion is coming from. We don't know the personal experiences of the person who has that opinion. And so let me quickly tell you, in the book, I tell the story of two people, a young hip hop artist named Genesis, born in raised Muslim, and somebody who would become her friend, a young white guy named Lewis. Genesis wants the Mississippi state flag to be changed because right now it sports slavery era symbolism. Whereas Lewis, who is a descendant of a Confederate soldier, wants it to stay the same. Now, you would think that Lewis is a racist, because he doesn't see the need to change the flag. But Genesis, instead of simply labeling his opinion repugnant, she actually sat down with him and discussed it with him. And she started by asking him, Lewis, how does the flag make you feel? And he answers and then asks her, how does it make you feel? And over the course of an afternoon, he comes to realize something quite surprising, that though he wants the flag to stay as is, he winds up caring more about Genesis than about the flag itself. And he has since not just taken down his own Confederate flag, but he has become one of her biggest supporters. So again, throw labels onto somebody simply because of the position they hold, but ask yourself, what change am I leaving on the table if I walk away prematurely?
Well, folks, Irshad Manji joins us this hour. Her new book is Don't Label Me, A Conversation for Divided Times. And she takes her provocative thesis even a step further, saying today's polarized politics stems from the shaming that the diversity movement's been doing. What do you think of that? We'll talk about that when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with Irshad Manji. Her new book is called Don't Label Me, A Conversation for Divided Times. And in the book, she presents the provocative thesis that it's people who champion diversity who may be one of the primary causes of the divided times we live in now. Is there a way for all of us to check our outrage at the door and listen to folks who we disagree with? Now, Irshad, I want to talk with you about your long exploration about shaming culture in American discourse and politics today here, because as I said, you write in the book that in your view, much of today's polarized politics stems from the shaming that the diversity movement's been doing, not only to the authentic racist, but to anyone who's got an honest disagreement with us, end quote. That's from your book. So I wanted to play what might be perhaps an example of that. This is from a recent debate last year over this question of what you call political correctness, I call progress. And the University of Toronto's Jordan Peterson participated in this debate. He routinely comes under attack from many liberals for his views. And Georgetown sociology professor Michael Eric Dyson debated Peterson on this. He called out Peterson on his white privilege. So in this cut, you're going to hear Professor Dyson first, and then a bit from Professor Peterson.
Jordan Peterson, trending number one on Twitter. Jordan Peterson, with an international bestseller. This is what I'm saying to you. Why the rage, bruh? You're doing well, but you're a mean, mad white man. And you're going to get us right. And
with regards to my privilege or lack thereof. I mean, I'm not making the case that I haven't had advantages in my life and disadvantages in my life like most people. You don't know anything about my background or where I came from, and it doesn't matter to you because fundamentally I'm a mean white man. That's a hell of a thing to say in a debate.
A debate last year between the University of Toronto's Jordan Peterson and Georgetown sociology professor Michael Eric Dyson. So, Irshad Manji, what do you hear in that?
I have watched that debate over and over again. And one thing to point out to our audience today is that, you know, Michael Eric Dyson's outburst, "You're a mean, mad white man," it wasn't simply an honest mistake. When given the opportunity to rephrase, he declined and he repeated to Peterson, you are a mean, mad white man. And Meghna, he got quite a healthy round of applause for that. So it's not like he was speaking only for himself. Now tell me this, does that not amount to racial reductionism? How does it not amount, those words, to racial profiling? And why, why is that perfectly acceptable to do to a white guy when it's not acceptable for a white guy or anybody else to do to a Michael Eric Dyson?
I personally do not have an answer to that. I don't, but...
I hope we hear from callers on that.
Offer what I have heard before. And that has to do with, it's not simply about Jordan Peterson, the individual straight white man. It's about American history. It's about the fact that there has been the endless practice of racial reductionism for as long as, you know, there have been... most people on this continent. I mean, you point out in the book itself that, you know, we took it to a masterful level in the Constitution of the United States, where the founding fathers determined African Americans to be mm-hmm. 3/5 of a person. So,
correct.
So given that context, that, you know, turnabout may be fair play here.
Sure. Given that context. But Meghna, in that statement, Professor Dyson was not giving that context. And you can well understand that when people watch, you know, those words spilling out of Professor Dyson's mouth, and he is directing them squarely at Professor Peterson, "You are a mean white, a mean, mad white man." He is speaking to the individual. And I have to say one other thing here. You know, it's exactly because we, the champions of diversity, have been so bad at communicating the larger picture in which these things are said, that over the last, I'm going to say, 15, 20 years, many people whom I have spoken with in the South, in the American South, in the Heartland, in the Midwest, you know, have told me, "Irshad, why is it that, you know, people in your crowd love to throw around words like racist and misogynist and homophobe at people who live in our region when they don't even know us? They don't know me as an individual, and they don't know us as, you know, as fellow Americans." And over the years that that's been done, many Americans have felt, and I'm going to use an important word here, humiliated, by constantly being told that they are something that they know they are not. And so you can appreciate why so many in that part of the country believe that people like you and me, the coastal elites, have the power. We have the power to distort who they are. And so unless we change, number one, our understanding of how power is distributed in our society, it's not only with straight white guys. We, too, increasingly have it on the liberal left. And number two, unless we change the way we advocate diversity, good luck bringing the holdouts on board.
Right.
We may actually be doing more harm to the cause than good. And if we really want, you know, President Trump, and I speak for myself here, not you, if we really want President Trump out of office, we've got to change how our advocacy, our activism, because we're only making him more appealing.
So So I really want to explore with you in a few minutes this sort of more honest assessment of power and privilege and what that means today. Very, very important. But you did bring up the elephant in the room, if I could put it that way, regarding President Trump, because is it not true that everything that you're saying, your critique of the champions of diversity, the progressive left, and the downside of how they've been shaming, for example, that you could actually, if you're being fully intellectually honest, that the president of the United States has for many years engaged in the exact same thing to great success.
Absolutely. And I hope you'll acknowledge that in the book, I am honest enough to not just acknowledge it, but to go into depth about it. This is why I want him out of office. You know, he is a man of vulgar, I'm going to say character, but frankly, I don't even see any character in him. My point simply is that we legitimize his use of shaming by reacting to it with shaming of our own. And then it becomes a vicious circle. So how can we say that we are all that different from him when, frankly, we don't behave all that differently from him, particularly when dealing with supporters of him?
Right. So on that point, I want to bring in another bit of tape here, another potential example, and get your thoughts on it. Because just a couple of weeks ago, comedian John Oliver did a segment on his show about public shaming, you know, and he does these long expositions about these major issues in American life right now. And he talked about the problems and the downsides of public shaming. But then he also argued in the same segment that not all public shaming is wrong, and that he said in certain ways it can make the world a better place. This is John Oliver's view. And in this portion of his segment, he went after Fox News host Tucker Carlson, and he played old recordings of Carlson, which had been recently unearthed, where Carlson calls Iraqis some terrible names. And so here's what John Oliver said.
Now, Tucker refused to apologize, and all week long, they've been trending hashtags like boycott Tucker Carlson and fire Tucker Carlson and Tucker Carlson is Roomba. That one wasn't technically trending, but I have this weird feeling that it will be in 20 minutes or so. And look, I would argue that Tucker is actually a good example of an internet pylon being merited. He's a public figure. He made his comments publicly. They are appalling, and he's standing by them.
John Oliver a couple of weeks ago, Irshad Manji, I mean, he's saying here that some righteous indignation is merited.
Some righteous indignation. The problem, of course, is that in our culture of not-so-casual cruelty, all we're really hearing is righteous indignation. I mean, just last week, right, was the righteous indignation over Joe Biden. And, you know, it occurred to me more than once that how many of us today, any of us, is doing or are doing something that also will be disapproved of 20 years from now. I, for example, still eat meat. I wish I didn't, and I'm trying to change that, and eventually I will. But, you know, I'm ripe for that kind of shaming 10 years, 20 years down the road. So let's first get honest about, you know, how we are imperfect as well. And in that context, to literally say, you know, coming from a place of imperfection, I know that, you know, I will be disapproved of at some point down the road. And so it's in the spirit of all of us evolving that I say this to you, Joe Biden. I just think, Meghna, that there is a smarter way to go about advocacy for equality than the impulsive, reactionary emotionalism that only feeds into the other side's emotionalism. So again, I bring it back to the, you know, to just the basic question. How is payback progress?
Well, folks, you're listening to Irshad Manji. Her new book is Don't Label Me, A Conversation for Divided Times. And she really does not mince words in the book. She says, quote, "When we, diversity supporters, clear space for diversity skeptics, then diversity will be consistent. It'll have integrity. It'll cease to be a shtick." Irshad, let's go to our callers. Nana is calling from Hallandale Beach, Florida. Nana, you're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to quickly respond to your statement about your flag story. I love that story you told. And I think it's not that we don't need to have difficult conversations, but I think we need to really learn how to have these difficult conversations and listen to understand and respond with compassion.
Nana, thank you for your call. Yeah, go ahead, Irshad.
I love that point, and the caller will be happy to know that, you know, at the end of the book, I do give several tips on the how of having these difficult dialogues. And indeed, one of those tips is listen to understand, not to win.
And so give us another one of your tips then.
Oh, well, here's a universal one. Because we're all born with brains that are first and foremost impulsive, we have to learn to outsmart the primitive part of our brain. And a very simple way to do that is by taking a breath before you decide to respond. Because when you take a breath, you are slowing down the blood rush in your body and literally slow jamming that lizard part of your brain, which then allows you to tap into the evolved part of the brain that's a lot less emotional, a lot more rational. And that's a great way of, you know, just buying that extra second so that you're not flipping out.
Okay. So almost sort of a mindfulness moment you're talking about.
And it is. It only really takes a moment to be mindful.
Okay. Is that an oversimplification, Irshad? Because you're talking about major divisions in American life right now. You're talking about core values, which seem to be in almost irresolvable conflict. And that could taking a deep breath and having a moment bridge those divides?
Well, you know, Meghna, it's not even so much that it's about bridging the divides. Rather, it's what the caller just pointed out, that we need to learn how to have conversations and not merely confrontations. So one of the other tips, and there are plenty of them in the book, is when you enter into a conversation with somebody with whom you passionately disagree, don't enter into it asking, how can I change that person's mind? Because if that's the question you're asking yourself, then you're going to be tempted to treat that person as an object to be manipulated. Instead, ask, what am I missing about this person? What don't I yet know about why they believe what they believe? And that, in turn, will develop relationships that, if many more of us took the time to do this and face-to-face as much as online, I dare say we wouldn't need to, you know, throw our hands up in the air and say, big divides, what are we supposed to do? Well, you know, it starts from the bottom up.
Well, so here's a question. Interestingly, on our website, Pat VT, I guess that's Pat in Vermont, is asking how to listen with an open mind to someone whose understanding of the facts are based on fake news or misinformation, and also how to reply to such a person without resorting to simply saying that's not true.
Right. First of all, sometimes you have to respond to someone by saying that's not true. The key question is, when do you do that? And, you know, neuroscientific research does show that when you take the time to hear the other person out, their emotional defenses will come down, so that you, in turn, will be more likely to get a fair hearing from them. The point is that when somebody starts off with so-called facts that you don't share, ask them questions. And ask them questions based on what you've just heard, not based on some hidden agenda that you want to bring, you know, to the conversation. Ask them, you know, interesting, like, what are your personal experiences that have brought you to that place? And the more they understand that you are in the conversation sincerely, the more they will be willing to hear the fact that then you're questioning their facts.
So again, it's
about when and how, just the what.
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you there, but we just have a minute to go before we have to take another break here. But I want to ask you, I hear your call for a more open dialogue between individuals. Absolutely. But there are a lot of folks who are saying the problem isn't necessarily on the individual-to-individual level, but it's about the systemic challenges that they're objecting to. And that is the reason why they're taking these positions about what diversity is or isn't.
Meghna, I hear this pushback all the time, and I welcome it, but what I have not yet heard is a compelling answer to this question. Since systems and structures and institutions are made up of people, how do they change systems and structures and institutions if the people themselves who inhabit them don't change?
Well, we'll explore that question when we come back. Irshad Manji joins us this hour. Her new book is Don't Label Me, A Conversation for Divided Times. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with Irshad Manji. Her new book is called Don't Label Me, A Conversation for Divided Times. Now, Irshad, before the break, you asked this question about how do you change systems which are made up of individuals without changing individuals? And I would say that one potential response would be put in place people who have greater power to change those systems. You know, sort of almost like a top-down approach that, leaders, great, more diverse leaders. That's what people talk about all the time. Why is that not a valid way to change a system versus on the ground, person to person?
Well, it may very well be part of the solution. I'm not for a minute rejecting it, that solution. But what I think is important to remember, Meghna, is that, again, you know, if you put a woman in a leadership position or a person of color or an LGBTQ person or a person with a disability, that's all well and good. And it's valuable in and of itself. But that doesn't necessarily mean the person will be bringing a wholly different perspective than that person's predecessor. Again, if we're judging people and assuming that they are that they have a particular a set of values based on the group affiliations that they've got, then we're not seeing them as individuals. We are once again reducing them to their group membership. That is not diversity. And frankly, having been a speechwriter for a political party leader in Canada who got that position strictly because she was a woman and who completely lost the next election because she simply wasn't leadership material, I can tell you that there are lots of dangers involved in merely inserting people with certain labels into positions if they don't already show, the characteristics of change that that institutions need.
Okay, so Irshad, I should have asked you a question much earlier then. What is your definition of diversity?
Well, as you know, in Don't Label Me, I distinguish between honest diversity and dishonest diversity. And dishonest diversity does, in fact, ruminate on group labels and group affiliations. It's dishonest because it doesn't see the complex plurality of the people who make up that group. Whereas honest diversity incorporates diversity of viewpoint. And that is a lot more respectful of how people think and not just what they look like. And I would say, by the way, that if we focused on diversity of viewpoint as the bottom line of diversity itself, we would naturally incorporate people of different classes and abilities and disabilities and complexions and genders precisely because those experiences do influence a viewpoint, but so do the experiences of all kinds of other people whose group affiliations, like cisgender white men, we write off as if their lives really don't matter.
Well, we've got lots of comments coming in online, you know, the digital world, that wonderful place for open and listening dialogue. But Eva Penton-Ryder says, thank you, Irshad Manji, for speaking on this issue. The hypocrisy of the current liberal culture's addiction to labeling and shunning is glaring, and it's time to own it and address it. Let's go back to our phones, though. Tommy is calling from Fredonia, New York. Tommy, you're on the air.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I'm a white male, and I really have to tell you that akin to the locker room talk that Trump got caught on tape with, you have to really understand that many women and many people of color aren't around a bunch of white guys when they're alone. When they think no one's listening, to hear what they actually think. I think being polite, being fair, all this sort of thing is idealistically great, but you just have no idea your colleagues, your friends, your coworkers, when a bunch of white guys get together and they think no one's listening, you'd be terrified of the things that they will say offhand and off comment. Mm-hmm. And I think that people like Peterson should be publicly shamed into oblivion.
Wow. Well, Tommy, forgive me for interrupting you, but I want to give Irshad a chance to respond to that. And Tommy, actually, someone online is sort of mirroring a point that you're making. Samantha Drake writes, Irshad seems to miss the whole point. It's less about someone's statistics as a white male, more about his beliefs, which often exclude or are based on racist beliefs. These people are afraid, this is what Samantha says, these people are afraid to lose their positions of privilege to someone they deem less than them. I think she's oversimplifying. I find her exhausting.
Thanks, Mom. Oh, sorry, that was somebody who called in.
No shaming.
No, none whatsoever. I was actually saying that my own mother finds me exhausting. So, you know, she's, I consider her part of the family already. Look, to Tommy, I would say, hey, I get it, man. Crude stuff comes out of people's mouths, and particularly the kinds of guys you're talking about. But what all I'm saying is, Tommy, you don't change people by insulting and berating and demeaning them. It's just, you know, that's the only point I'm making. By all means, we should seek change, but do it in a way that is constructive so that it sticks. And to the woman whom, you know, I jokingly called my mom, the woman who finds me exhausting, you know, all I can tell you is that there are plenty of people of color and women and LGBTQ people and you name it, who also in their private moments hold views that you would find surprising and unpleasantly so. That's because they're human beings and individuals. And, you know, should we not hold them accountable too? Again, my point is that simply by looking at group membership, you fail to take into account that, as the novelist Zadie Smith pointed out, we are all internally plural. So if I'm missing the point, then that's my bad, that I'm, you know, communicating myself in a lousy way. But I think the point I'm trying to get across is just simple. It's not about being nice for the sake of nice or polite for the sake of polite. It's about being humane for the sake of strategic change.
So about this being internally plural here.
Yeah.
I mean, I think is what you're saying is part of the problem is that we're there are fewer and fewer spaces where we can express that internal plurality without fear of shaming or humiliation.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. Exactly. But what I find so interesting and you know, just based off of the last couple of interventions from the audience, that we tend to ignore that you know, people who are considered historically marginalized because they come from groups that have been historically marginalized. And again, I emphasize the word historically. We tend to ignore that they too, you know, can be just as frankly ignorant as the, you know, straight white guy can be. Why is it that we're not willing to give the historically marginalized, the members of those historically marginalized groups, the same humanity and the same high expectations that we expect of others? Notice I'm not saying that we should have low expectations of, you know, cisgender white men. I'm saying let's assign them the humanity that is theirs and let's have higher expectations of all of us, including those of us who fancy ourselves enlightened, but then lose our cool the moment somebody disagrees with our point of view.
Well, let's go to Alyssa, who's calling from Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Alyssa, you're on the air.
Hi, Magna. First, I just want to applaud your guest for the work that she's doing. As someone who studies vulnerability, I think this discussion is incredibly important. My question is around the idea of those who might use her argument as a way to sort of ignore power structures, so essentially weaponizing the argument for their own benefit, bringing to mind the "not all men" hashtag. So what would your guests say to those people who might co-opt it for their own purposes?
You know, it's a problem that I've had to deal with over the last couple of decades because, you know, my previous two books have been about the need for reform within my faith of Islam. And the worry is constant that, you know, legitimate, like, Islamophobes, Islam bashers will hijack, you know, my work to further their own intolerant agendas. All I can tell you is that whenever I encounter that sort of thing, I hold the people who weaponize, you know, my my arguments, I hold them accountable, in this case, for their own unwillingness to practice the dignity and respect that I'm talking about. And I ask them exactly the same question as, you know, I ask my fellow liberals and progressives, which is, how do you expect anybody to understand where you're coming from if you're not willing to do that for them?
So, Irshad, if I can just switch gears here for a moment, because earlier in the show I said that I did want to explore with you two of the major ideas that you'll hear progressives talk about a lot, and that is power and privilege. These are, in fact, central to how a lot of progressivism does engage with the world right now, interrogations of power and privilege. But you write here in the book, you say, quote, "A lot of people who think of themselves as marginalized actually wield power. And a lot of the time, they're unconscious that they're wielding it. As a result, power's exercised poorly or even destructively." And then you say, "Some mad hopping might be in order." Indeed. I mean, that's a very provocative thing to say. What do you mean?
Well, you know, the context in which I've said that is I tell the story of a student at NYU where I used to teach. Vanessa was her name. And you know, she absolutely denied that she had any power. And yet, when it came to working for social justice, she, precisely because she was an African-American woman, she had the kind of power to approve whether white students would be, you know, would be seen as fellow activists alongside her. And what she would always say to white students is, "It's not my job to educate you." All right, I asked Vanessa, then, you know, could you at least, you know, give these students some recommendations for readings that they could do? Nope, she said, because then I'd be doing their work for them. And so ultimately, I asked Vanessa, you know, how do you see how you're putting a lot of white students in a no-win position, that even when they educate themselves, if they're not educating themselves with the exact resources that you think are correct, then once again, they're behind the eight ball,
right,
as far as you're concerned. And simply to say that, you know, in a situation like that, she has what many progressives call the social capital. She has the power to approve these students as fellow travelers. And so, again, the point that I'm making in the book is that power comes in different forms and is distributed in different ways. And what we may think of as our powerlessness in the great, you know, wide system out there, we may be right about that. But in certain situations in here, we still have the power that others don't.
So, Irshad, we've just got a couple of minutes left here, and I have two final sets of questions for you. One is that you say in the book, and you've said here in this conversation, something that leads to the conclusion that is what you're saying that efforts towards a truly diverse America will ultimately be could be self-defeating if the champions of diversity don't get buy-in from everybody?
Well, yes, by definition, because then we're practicing not from everybody. Sorry, let me be more clear. You can't get buy-in from everybody, but you can get more buy-in from more people. And what I'm pointing out is that we in the diversity crowd are not yet making the effort to expand diversity so that it incorporates different viewpoints. We are practicing we're practicing exclusion in the name of inclusion, which is why diversity is seen as hypocrisy by so many people today.
Okay, but in the ideal of inclusion, though, it's to bring people in who have been historically excluded. And if there's a limited space for that group of people, doesn't it by definition means that some others may be pushed out, even if it's temporarily?
Well, first of all, tell that to the people who are being pushed out that it's temporary. It strikes them as unfair because it is. Now, when you say historically, you know, marginalized, well, what about, you know, poor white men who were in American history, as oppressed in the early days of the Republic as black folk were. So again, where does it end? My point is that, you know, for diversity to have integrity, we've got to start practicing it now as a capacious, generous concept that that if it's going to leave anybody out, we better be prepared to explain why that's fair. And if you're going to be resorting to abstract notions of power and systemic, you know, discrimination, that is a totally unrelatable way for human beings, to communicate with one another.
Well, I'm going to sneak one more question here in 50 seconds. So given that, how would you define what individual moral courage should look like today?
Moral courage means doing the right thing in the face of your fears. And that doesn't just mean standing up and speaking truth to power externally. It means speaking truth to the most pervasive, pernicious power that there is universally, and that is our own egos.
Well, Irshad Manji's new book is Don't Label Me, A Conversation for Divided Times. We have an excerpt of it at onpointradio.org. Irshad, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you so very much.
Pleasure is all mine.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.